Hello and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Danny Denton. I'm the editor of the Stinging Fly, and I'm joined on the podcast today by Niamh Campbell. Niamh's debut novel, This Happy, was published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson in 2020, and we were very lucky to get to publish an excerpt from it in the summer 2020 issue of the magazine. This Happy was nominated for an Irish Book Award, the Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year Award, and the John McGahan Book Prize. In 2020, she also won the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award for her story, Love Many. Her short work can be found in the Dublin Review, 3am, Banshee, Tangerine, Five Dials, Granta, The Stinging Fly, and Gorse. And we also have fiction by Niamh up on the Stinging Fly website at the moment. She's the 2021 Writer-in-Residence at University College Dublin, and her second novel, We Were Young, is forthcoming in 2022. Welcome aboard, Niamh.
Thank you, Danny.
How are things?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So on each podcast, we ask a writer to select a work from our archive, and we then deep dive into the work and see what we can find. Niamh, do you want to tell us what you've selected?
Sure. I've chosen The Dead Hotel by Kevin Power, which is from issue 4, volume 2, summer of 2006. So it's a long time ago. It's prior to Bad Day and Black Rock. So it might be one of the first, if not the first, published works by Kevin Power.
Fantastic. I think he's a year ahead of me. I think I have my Sting and Fly, popped my Sting and Fly cherry in 2007. So always a little bit jealous of people that got there before me. Fantastic. Do you want to read it for us?
Sure. So it's called The Dead Hotel. June 11th. There are no flights landing on the island anymore. Ours was the very last one. At Palma, gingerly, ears ravaged by the faulty air pressure of an economy flight from Dublin, we hauled our bags off the lethal treadmill and staggered out into the sunshine. Didn't get lost once. You couldn't miss the arrivals hall. There were no other tourists in it, just the clerks and the baggage handlers clerking and handling baggage. On holiday in Mallorca, Isabel, Chris, Emer and my good self. White rented rooms, sapphire heft of a lilting pool. Female flesh set quivering by my playful slap as I walk past Isabel, who is draped across a poolside plastic lounger as I write this, reading an airport paperback called Sex Lives of the Nazi Doctors. Our block is called Palm Tree Villas. There is one withered palm tree and a pudgy fair-haired boy who stands beside it. He's about 9 years old. That's what he does. He stands beside the tree from noon to midnight. I've seen him there every day so far. That first afternoon, as we shuffled past on our way to the apartment, I spotted a fat brown 3-inch cockroach squatting on the bark of the tree. The fair-haired boy was watching it, scrutinizing it really, like a doctor worrying over a stool sample, and as I came level with him, he reached out a hand and closed a sweaty, patient fist over the twitching segments of the insect's body. I don't know what he did with it. Today is my first sober day. I got out of bed early at noon and I had all sorts of holiday plans, but it's late afternoon now and you don't want to go outside in that murderous heat. It punches you in the gut every time you step outside. The gut, the face, the shoulder blades. But the holiday is doing us good. I can see it in Isabel, of course, but in Chris and Emer most of all. Their drinking has improved. I take this to be a good sign. They've stayed in bed with hangovers all day, which means I'm alone with Isabel. So, things are looking up. June 12th. This morning, Isabel and I went to the supermarket. She was wearing ragged cotton shorts, and if I let myself fall a few paces behind, I could take in the peerless sway of her ass as she walked through the shade under the awnings. We stocked up on beer and whiskey. You'll dehydrate yourselves, Chris said, as, lounging on the terrace, we punctured our first cans of the day. But I already feel comprehensively dehydrated. I feel like a husk laid out to dry beneath the stinging sun. I'm not quite drunk as I write this. A few more rum and cokes will take me nicely towards bedtime, and for those I'll have to head to the bar in Paradise Isle, the neighbouring apartment block. There's a barbecue on there this evening. Americans and Brits in Hawaiian shirts are already assembling by the clear pool, counting the roaches and mosquitoes that flap against its surface tension. The fair-haired boy was there again today, keeping his perpetual vigil beside his wilting tree. Still no sign of his parents. June 13th. Isabel and I skulked by the edge of the pool as Chris and Emer waited for food at the barbecue. Some of the Americans had found a haunch of beef for sale at the supermarket and were doling out chunks of it from beside the grill like bourgeois businessmen at a charity drive. I was watching Chris, who was in shallow conversation with a loud-shirted American. Emer arrived carrying drooping paper plates of bloody meat. I don't know how cooked it is, she said. I don't even know what it is, but it beats having to cook for ourselves. I didn't touch any of the beef. Alcohol used to sharpen my appetite, but now it seems to do the opposite. My appetite is crushed, blunted, pulped. Yesterday I picked up the book that Isabel totes round and read that Dr. Mengele liked to sodomise young Jewish maidens before ordering that they be flayed alive. I think I saw a film about this once. Chris brought his American friend over. "This is Jerry," he said. "He's from Australia, from Cranberry, Australia." Jerry grinned as though this were a terrific joke. "Oh," Isabel squealed, "I lived in Canberra for 3 months." "Cranberry," Chris insisted. We stood around holding our drinks. Jerry studied Isabel with creased, alarming eyes. I put my arm around her freckled shoulders. Jerry leaned into us. "Have you guys heard the rumours?" I smiled a Buddhist smile. Sharer of knowledge, hoarder of inner peace. "No," Isabel said, wriggling out from under my arm. "What's the story now?" Jerry gave a professional's grimace. "Someone was telling me the other day that for 5 minutes CNN was reporting strikes over the DRC. They killed the story, though, right after. You know, because they didn't want anyone to know about it. Like the massacres in Tennessee." "We still don't know," I said loftily, "what actually happened." "And what would that mean?" Isabel asked. "Fallout," Jerry the Australian said. "Just fallout. Here, there, and everywhere." My memories of the rest of the night are confused. I can tell you what I saw or what I think I saw. Isabel talking to Jerry, Jerry talking to Emer. He's talking about birth defects, how reports of them are spreading from somewhere to somewhere else. Chris bellowing "Cranberry" at anyone who'll listen. Isabel and Jerry disappearing somewhere, the gasps of amusement and fear as a helicopter makes a flyby overhead, an American screaming that he's burned his hand on the barbecue, Chris telling me he's discovered something important but he's not sure what, the blackened furry remains of the side of beef being thrown into the pool, turning the water a misty charcoal grey, me searching for Isabel, but there is no Isabel to be found. I don't even remember finding my way back to our apartment. I folded into my own bed though, and I lay there, eyes riveted on the ceiling, listening to the angry sounds of the barbecue as they faded with the first light of another burning day. From the balcony this morning, crinkled newspaper in one hand and sprightly orange juice in the other, I saw the fat blonde boy move for the very first time. He abandoned his tree and went to look at the ruined pool, fixing his equable gaze on the black corpse of beef under the water. "Hooray," I said, "it's alive," but there was no one around to hear me. With this morning's hangover came the sad, slow burn of remorseful jealousy. Of course Isabel had fucked Jerry. Every morning now, more people waking up in the wrong room. I decided that if I found Jerry, I would kill him. Chris shuffled onto the balcony and winced down at the remains of the pool. That was a good one. I don't remember it. Neither do I. I'm going on the physical evidence. He took from his pocket a little black notebook and began to scribble something. Inside my gut, a miniature Chernobyl, a toy town, 3 mile island fizzed and crackled. Chris closed his notebook. "Shall we begin the hunt?" "The hunt? For Emer. She's out there somewhere." "Why, where? She went off with the cranberry man. Made me promise to track her down this morning if she didn't find her way home." "Where's Isabel?" I croaked. "In bed," Chris said. "Better bring her some juice." 2 hours later, we found Emer in an apartment, in an empty apartment, identical to ours, but with a smashed television, and with an investigative line of ants powdered across the kitchen lino. Emer didn't wake up, so we carried her home. The room we found her in had drugs. You know what I mean? It had drugs like other rooms have carpet or furniture. But there was no sign of Jerry, our man from Canberra, and no food in the fridge, no clothes in the wardrobe. June 16th. They still haven't cleaned the water. Now you can't swim. Nobody dares to go near the sea. You can't sit by the pool. Its restful shimmer has been replaced by a static grey slime. Parties have moved inside. You can hear them faintly at the peak of noon during the worst of the heat. This evening I went for a walk along the beach. The sand was full of insects, white skittish things that scattered along your footsteps. I ran into Jerry. We went for a drink at one of the beachside bars. Of course, I had no reason to kill him now. The bar was one of those expat places run by a middle-aged British couple. Pinned on the walls was a lifetime's worth of football memorabilia. Remember football? It seems laughable now, all that organisation. Jerry talked at length about the political predicament. Some friends of his arrived, a hippie girl with tie-dyed shirt and braided hair, and another young Australian named Alex, who told us he was on his way home from Morocco but was stranded now. Marooned. "It's Eden here," Jerry told him. "Paradise, mate." We ordered more sangria. We headed back to the apartments, but as soon as you leave the little seafront, the streets are empty. Voices rebound from the whitewashed walls. Turn a corner and there they are. A dozen men in black military gear, gas masks slung casually around their thick necks, building a roadblock. Jerry, Hawaiian shirt open at the collar, palms raised in a placatory advance, shouted something in pidgin Spanish. "It's all right," he said over his shoulder. "They're just setting up a checkpoint." He went towards one of the soldiers, who greeted him by gently slinging the butt of his rifle into Jerry's stomach. A skillful pinched chop to the back of the neck sent Jerry all the way down. The lead soldier motioned to two others. It was a lazy wave, a valediction almost, who came over and kicked Jerry until he stopped moving. The lead soldier stared at us for a minute. Then he smiled cheerfully, like a prosperous maitre d', and waved us on. After a while, we wound up in a dead-end street. Dry sheets flapped below washing lines. Short steps led to barred doors. The girl sat down beneath some railings and began to cry. She was pregnant, and Jerry was the father, and now what would she do? I embraced her. It seemed to be what she wanted. When I looked up, Alex was gone. When I tried to stand, I braced my palm on a shard of glass. Blood welled generously. I used a fragment of my t-shirt to bandage it. When I got back to our apartment, Isabel and Chris were cooking dinner and Emer was curled in a chair on the balcony, turning and turning the pages of a newspaper. They were busily happy. Chris noticed my wounded hand, and the boy was there again today. What does he know about us, about me? What's his game? June 17th. Last night, Isabel and I slept in the same bed. I pressed my bandaged palm to her flesh where her t-shirt rose a little. I dreamed of a bristling Irish woodland after rain. Broken branch and rustling twig, microscopic ecology of glinting rain and shaken leaves. The sky opens itself above me. Someone is out here, heart beating too quickly, not from a chase, but from something else, a sense of otherness, guilt or ghost or apprehension. June 19th. Chris has shut himself in his room with his notebook and the newspapers. He speaks to us through the door. He asked me to get him more tabloids, more broadsheets. I went to the supermarket where the shelves are emptying. The corridors of Palm Tree Villas are filling with rubbish. This morning I found three suitcases in the third floor stairwell, bulging with clothes and ready to go, but nobody arrived to claim them, and they were still there this evening as the parties kicked into gear. June 22nd. The fat boy. His clothes change. This much I do know. He wears a different t-shirt every day. There is always a white shield of lotion on his nose. What does he do? He guards the palm tree. This palm tree seems to need guarding too. It needs him to look after it. He touches it occasionally, reaching out a raw hand. He takes away the swarming cockroaches. I watch him from the willowy shade of the poolside showers. He gently lifts away the careless roaches and I know what he does with them now. June 23rd. Chris has not emerged. He has a theory, Emer insists, about why all this is going on. It has to do with the durability of tourism, he tells her through the door. It's essentially an amoral activity. Calamity has no effect on its processes. Isabel and I lie awake at night listening to the punctured cascade of broken glass as windows break all over the complex. I can feel a sort of toxic swell flowing outwards from the wound in my hand. I shouldn't have cut it in retrospect. That was a bad move. Isabel and Emer sent me down for more drinks. In the Palm Tree Villas bar, half a dozen Englishmen were aimlessly perambulating. When they'd calmed me down, I must have been shouting, they told me that the bar appeared to have run out of alcohol. I went back upstairs and told the crew. How could they have allowed this to happen? Isabel asked through her tears. At the sink, I unwound the bandage from my injured hand. I may have just imagined a greenish tinge to the edges of the folded cut. I was woken at 5 in the morning by what sounded like a gaggle of kids trooping past my window on their way to school. I stumbled to the balcony and looked out over the blackened swimming pool towards the edges of the complex. Down the little seafront street they came, 100 of them or more, tourists in their shorts and sunglasses, carrying rucksacks and suitcases, clutching bundles of clothes and bottles of vodka like refugee mothers fleeing a war zone. No one appeared to be hurrying. Isabel joined me at the crumbling parapet. Where are they coming from? She asked. I could hardly see her in the dawn light. From the hotel, I said. Some of the women were carrying televisions and trouser presses, and the men brought with them cordless hairdryers and shower caps. As the dawn began to subtly burn, the march continued, young men and women with varying degrees of suntan pressing their sneakers and flip-flops to the concrete road. I watched them until the sun came up and the last of them had disappeared into the town. Isabel went back to bed, squeezing my hand as she left. I barely noticed the human warmth of her fingers. I can't say why, but I was fascinated, even mesmerised, by the stately progress of the hotel guests. I knew there was no reason for it. Even if I had seen military men, densely powerful in their uniforms, shepherding, gentle word, the walking masses, I would have known. There was no reason for it. Throughout it all, the fat boy stood stoically by his palm tree, unstirred by the spectacle of abandonment taking place 100 yards away. I watched until the last of their cushioned feet had drifted out of earshot and I was left alone with the contents of my own astonished heart. Then I went inside and drained the last mercurial shimmer from Emer's bottle of vodka. June 26th. The hotel looms above us now. Chris believes something serious happened there and that whatever it was will soon happen to Palm Tree Villas. Emer has collected all of our bottles and emptied their listless dregs into a single tumbler from which we are allowed to take hourly sips. But it isn't working, I'm sobering up. The cut of my hand has taken to bleeding peaceably during the night. This is no longer the holiday I envisioned. Chris has begun to pass notes underneath his door. One read, "This is all we have left. The poetry of sun and shadow on a fuselage, the poetry of airports and coach travel, the poetry of unnoticed electrical sockets and wipe clean floors." Another read, "Can't we all just get along?" Emer stares at them for hours, attempting to make sense of them. The boy, the boy, the boy, the boy, the boy. June 29th. Last night at around midnight, my fever broke. While everyone else slept, I cleaned out the cut on my hand. I checked out the dawn. I looked over my notes here. I don't remember a lot of this stuff or why it seemed important. The exodus from the hotel, the soldiers, Chris's notes. What is important, what deserves my immediate and full attention, is the fact that we have totally run out of beer. To kill time, I left the apartment and wandered round the complex. Several rooms had been taken over by feral cats, little walking bags of tetanus and fever. Two floors above us, a party seemed to be in progress. The lifts were broken, so I risked the stairwells. Two unconscious girls in football jerseys, but nothing to be afraid of. The penthouse door had been taken off its hinges. I went inside, kicking my way through crumpled cans and spinning bottles. Three girls and a guy were basking in the balcony hot tub. The guy was Jerry, tenderly cradling a bottle of Jack Daniels and squinting at me through two poppy-coloured black eyes. "Howdy, mate," he said guardedly. "Jerry," I said, "I'm looking for beer. Have you seen any?" There was a silence. "No," Jerry said, "not here, mate." When I got back to our apartment, the fair-haired boy was standing on our balcony, staring down at the motionless swimming pool. We gathered around Chris's locked door and confronted the reality of our situation. What we decided was this. Isabel and I will take the fair-haired boy and go to the empty hotel to check for supplies of food and drink. The idea was Chris's. He is curious about what happened at the hotel. We'll set out at nightfall when things are quiet, when the screams from Paradise Isle have dwindled into restless silence and the troops by the seashore have gone home for the night. June 30th. We set out along the beach at the edge of the incoming tide. The hotel had its own section of beach marked off by a cluster of baking rocks. The building still had electricity. Yellow light flickered in some windows and the open-air bar, the only way into the hotel from the beach, still cranked hilarious holiday tunes into the summer twilight. We picked our way among the tables. The boy led us through the bar, with its rolling tables and spilled drinks, into the main lobby. "It's deserted," Isabel said. And deserted it was. The revolving door had partly shattered. Spidery contortions of seminal white threaded their way through the sheets of glass. Clothes, condoms and books were scattered on the plush floor and across the leather couches. Behind the mahogany reception desk, the keys still hung in their numbered slots. Newspapers waved with the breeze from the air conditioning. Most striking of all, the cash register had been overturned. An eruption of paper money and credit card receipts covered the floor behind the desk. There was blood and beaded glass in the pile of the carpet. And there was silence. Tumult, meditative silence. Silence that does not expect to be disturbed. The fair-haired boy went straight through the devastated lobby to the alcove where they kept the elevators and pressed the call button. Isabel kicked at a crumpled, bloody T-shirt. "What do you think happened?" "They cleared out," I said stupidly. I looked around, turned a complete circle, but there was nothing and nobody, just the invasive stillness of evening on the island, that time when all the kids come out to play. A feathery ping, like a microwave's cue, announced the arrival of a lift. The boy's excitement caught our attention. We followed him into one of the glacial mirrored cages and he pressed, without giving it much thought, the button for the 55th floor. Isabel and I glumly preened our reflections in the golden wall. I wasn't surprised, of course, when the doors opened into total darkness. But Isabel was. "Shit," she said. Even the fat boy seemed to hesitate a little. He scratched a blistered ear with his pudgy fingers. We stared into the black corridor. It reminded me of a dream I had once as a child with a child's unreasonable fear of unlit spaces. "Monsters," I thought, "we'll find monsters in the dark." But the boy led us inevitably forward into the corridor and turned left into a patch of cool air. It was even quieter up here, the bristling ogre silence of a large hotel. I took Isabel's hand and we followed the boy. It was a strangely peaceful pursuit. We could have been calmly stumbling for a quarter of an hour. Eventually we hit a cold wall, the end of the corridor. Off to our right, a tongue of amber light lolled across the carpet. The boy stood at the door of an open room, looking at something inside. I walked towards him. Did Isabel come with me? She must have. We were alone now, waiting for our monsters. The boy disappeared inside his room. It was an ordinary hotel room, odourless and without character. The only thing you noticed was the TV squatting in the corner. Ghostly programs trickled through the intermittent static. It seemed to be a news report. You could see roadblocks, piles of dead Americans, freeze-frame shots of a grey explosion. The fair-haired boy watched it with touristic awe. Isabel went to the window and looked through the curtains, out at the fires that erupted beyond the bay. I stood behind her, and somehow, you know how these things work out, I put my arms around her little waist, and she arched her back welcomingly. When she turned to kiss me, I wasn't surprised. I fitted the cup of my injured hand to her breast, all the time tuned in to the permanent crash and buzz of the TV news, and we kissed more earnestly. We began to climb out of our clothes. The fair-haired boy watched television while we fucked on the edge of the hotel bed. Around us, the hotel did not wake up. We were very quiet, Isabel and I, and afterwards we cried as undramatically as we could. When we finished, I noticed that the fat boy was holding a box of matches that bore the logo of the hotel bar. He offered them to me without emphasis. I took them and set a fire in the corner of the room at the feet of the drawn curtains. We left the boy watching television in the room on the 55th floor and found our way back to the lobby and then to the beach. Still naked, we ran off along the temperate sand, feeling sick and filthy, desperate to find our way home. July 1st. Mum rang today to tell me that I passed my exams and that my enrolment papers for next year are in the post. Our flight home, she reminded me, as if I were still a kid, was in 3 days. Dad and I missed you, she said. She was even starting to cry a bit. I have to move out next year. There's only so much of his parents a man can be expected to take.
You just heard The Dead Hotel by Kevin Power, read by Niamh Campbell. Kevin Power, just to give you a bit of background on the writer, is a writer of fiction, a teacher of fiction, and a critic. He has published 2 novels to date, Bad Day at Black Rock and White City, and was a recipient of the Rooney Prize for Literature in 2009. As Niamh told you beforehand, The Dead Hotel was published in issue 4 of the Stinging Fly magazine way back in the summer of 2006. It's a brilliant choice, Niamh, and I kind of have to admit I hadn't read it before, and I was rereading it doing my prep yesterday while in City Hall in Cork. And City Hall is a kind of a strange place at the moment because it's the vaccination centre, so I was getting my first jab, and it's surrounded by those kind of white, those apocalyptic white canvas tents you queue up. And it feels like the end of the world. And so after they give you the jab, you have to wait 15 minutes so you know that they're sure that you aren't going to collapse or have a fit or something. And so everyone's sitting in this waiting zone with kind of sore shoulders, listening to weird music. And I was reading this thinking, this is actually it. It's the end of the world. So that's all a way of saying it. The story felt not 15 years old, it felt 15 minutes old. It felt as fresh and devastating now as it probably would have in 2006. How did you come across it? How is this your pick from the totality of our archive?
Well, I was having a look out of curiosity at what was in the Stinging Fly around that, like a good few years ago, you know, perhaps when I first became aware of the magazine. So in 2006 was the year that I finished school. And I'm also interested at the moment in writing about Ireland's Generation X and the Generation X imaginary. And I would place Kevin Power as a writer just about in that bracket. So when I found this story, which I think is a very Generation X-y story, it just fit perfectly. It is very prescient. It looks uncannily, you know, like relevant for this year. But what strikes me about it is that it's got this like American eschatological imagination thing going on where it's man-made disaster and war that ends the world, as opposed to virus. And also it sort of combines that idea that's very, it's almost like there's a, that idea of fantasy of the end of the world coming through what is basically American foreign policy, or this sort of slightly fascistic Cold War imaginary, combined with a Leaving Cert holiday. And this is about, this is around the time, I suppose, that Bad Day in Black Rock is being written, which is a book that combines Norman Mailer sensibility with a Leaving Cert holiday.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love this application of that imaginary to kind of an Irishy context.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, in teaching fiction, I'm always trying to talk to students about, and it's always really difficult to describe, is how all my favorite stories take these wild left turns at the end.
Mm.
And it's not that it's suddenly a different thing or something like that. It's that somehow this total surprise at the end is completely inevitable, and it kind of reframes things in an inevitable way. And I was blown away by that ending when I read it first. I'm really interested in this generational thing, because it was something I'm 38 years old, born in 1983. I think I'm like one of the first millennials. Is that right in your understanding? Generation X is before that?
Yes, I think it should be a little bit looser with Ireland because everything is slightly delayed here. So I would say, officially speaking, millennials begin in 1985. So you're just about Generation X.
But Okay.
So I would kind of name it as people who came of age or were formed by the 1990s.
Okay, fantastic. And so how, in that sense, this story, like one thing that struck me about it was that kind of, I've had a Leaving Cert holiday. Have you had a Leaving Cert holiday? Do we both have that in our locker, these boozy holidays?
Definitely. Okay. Those holidays, those package holidays around about the time when you were departing from the family, and there's that kind of grotty package holiday feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the drinking, that's the thing I was going to bring up, is that he keeps coming back to, oh, the worst thing of all is there's no booze. And when you get this new reframe at the end, like this is a guy on his Leaving Cert holiday or J1 holiday, whatever it might be, that alcohol concern doesn't go, like that is the, like that's the main concern. And that line in the first diary entry, today is my first sober day, I felt kind of embarrassed reading that line, because I was thinking, I've definitely thought of holidays in those terms.
Yeah.
I had a brilliant holiday because I didn't have a sober day. I managed to drink every day. And so generationally, it certainly had me reflecting. And there was another thing about the idea of parents as well, is that kind of, I don't know how you feel about it, but this is something I feel about, I would say my generation, but I wasn't quite sure what my generation is. We don't really seem to grow up. Like, I still think of myself as a kid with parents. And I reckon my parents don't think of themselves as kids with parents. They think of themselves as parents.
Yeah, that might be the last generation that had that feeling, because from the 90s onwards, there's this blurring of, like, I suppose a classic Gen X idea coming from America is a very hothoused generation of people brought up with a very strong education system and a lot of very progressive policy, meeting with the total banality of the 90s, the total banality of the working world, and the loss of all forms of security and tradition, therefore kind of wandering adolescent generation. And what I really find interesting, this is completely me nerding out, is in the Irish version, writers who are kind of writing in this interim a lot of the time, their influences are very American and their influences are very anti-Irish. They don't want to write traditional Irish kind of style writing. They're kicking back against Banville and McGahern and Heaney, probably because Heaney was a big figure in the 90s. So this American imaginary, which I see in this story, is really pervasive. And it's like it's reaching out for like youth culture and cynicism from somewhere else to try and bulk up this identity that's, I don't need my parents, I don't need Ireland. And, you know, it's kind of, millennials seem to have sort of mellowed out a little bit afterwards. So I kind of, there's a bump in the 90s of thinking about how big grunge was at the time.
Yeah,
and the J Wood became a big thing, and the going to New York to buy bootleg jeans became a thing.
Yeah, and apocalyptic movies, like every month there was an apocalyptic movie came out. And like, I love loads of them. I could be this character, I feel like that.
Yeah.
I'm fantasizing. It's weird, I used to teach secondary school, and when you're talking like ages kind of 13 to 16, all the fantasies are of murder and stabbing and suicide. And I kind of used to think, oh, that's just kids, they're figuring out like what's at stake in the world. But of course, then you're 18, 19, 20, and now like nearly 40 or whatever, and all the fantasies are the end of the world, which is kind of strange because we do feel like we're living a bit in the end of the world.
But, I know, it is the same. Like this end of the world feels like, I guess it's America digesting Vietnam and digesting the Cold War, culturally speaking, end of history vibe where there's nowhere further to go. And so there's no point in doing anything except getting shit-faced. Whereas the millennial thing is this sort of weird, urgent, annoying, perennial obligation to do something about it, which is crap. You know, like, I'd rather just get wasted on the beach and say, this isn't my fault, you know.
I don't have the energy for this. Absolutely. That's fantastic. So where do you place this? So do you reckon then this is a writer like rejecting those kind of Irish influences? And maybe, I don't know, I was thinking a lot about Ballard, who's not American, but I was thinking a lot about David Lynch as well, actually, to be honest.
You're right. I mean, I guess I'm kind of biased in this direction because I've been writing about Generation X. And when I interviewed Kevin Power a couple of weeks ago or a few months ago, I asked him about Irish influences. Do you see yourself in the Irish canon? I felt like he was a very emphatic no. He's an Americanist as well. So I suppose I took that assumption that that's where it was headed. But I do think it's kind of interesting that I would still say, I would say now on mature recollection, he wrote the most Celtic Tiger book of all. The lasting one, I think the best one of all the shots at it. Because another characteristic of this generation is trying to write the Celtic Tiger and not really getting it right, I think, because they're pulling from these influences too much. Like there's books I won't name, which are basically just sort of fantasies of America transplanted to Ireland, whereas Bad Day and Black Rock is very close to the reality. So that's quite an achievement. So that's why I was asking, did you see yourself as having this kind of cultural, belonging to this cultural scene or anything? And he is really very, very emphatic no.
Okay.
So I think that's taking that and running with it.
Fantastic. What about the story then, say, on one thing I've noticed about Kevin that he's doing that I think is quite noble is when he's talking about writing at the moment, obviously he's got a book out and you have to write these articles and things. He's talking a lot about the technical side of it and not the boring side of it, but say the real hard work of it. Mm. And I've heard him talking about sentences and paragraphs and style. He's obviously got a piece up on the Sting and Fly website at the moment about reviewing and criticism. Mm. Will we have an attempt at picking out some of the technical delights of the story? Were there particular things that impressed you that he did, or those kind of things?
The first thing that impresses me is that this is, you know, a very young man's story. He would only have been in his early 20s, and it feels just very accomplished. It doesn't read like juvenilia, you know. It's really solid, and I don't know how long it took to write or how much editing went into it, but there's very little in it that is baggy or regretful. It's strong. Apart from the sort of sustained imaginary and the images and the characters and everything, and the really disturbing thing about the beef going into the pool.
Yeah, what a symbol.
There's some wonderful images. I mean, in sentences, and it's very easy to read for that reason, because there's no sentence that is left without, you know, kind of being worked over and made.
Yeah.
There's a very short depiction of Jerry being beaten up by soldiers, which is ultimately about seven sentences, but you can see it so well. So, you know, greeted him gently, slinging the butt of his rifle into his stomach, skillful pinched chop to the back of the neck, and then motioned to two others, lazy wave, valediction, and then the prosperous Major D. And it's accomplished in like a very short amount of time. You can completely see this effortlessly.
And throwing you off in the sense of kind of unassuming adverbs and things like that, idea of gently slinging the butt of his rifle. It's always done, it kind of almost makes it funny, like these depictions of things being, there's a, when he cuts his hand, it's like the blood welled generously. And what's really wonderful about a lot of that stuff is that threat, that violence always seems kind of, it's treated with kind of a very confident nonchalance or something, but it's always kind of lurking on the edge. Like, I think, I can't remember actually specifically, but do they turn a corner or get to the end of a street? And that's where these guys in black military gear are lurking. And obviously they then proceed to gently beat the crap out of Jerry. That actually, when I was reading that, that brought to mind another drinking holiday when we went to the, Euros in whenever it was, and we were having a great time supporting Ireland in the Euros. And again, another one of those ones where you're 16 days, you're thinking, 8 days, I still haven't had a day off the booze, and like, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I remember turning a corner, all this booze, and I turned a corner, and the riot police were just waiting quietly off this square in Poznan, I think it was, in Poland, waiting for trouble. And actually, you know, they weren't going to beat anyone up, and I don't think they did beat anybody up. But just sudden kind of turning a corner going, oh shit, like death.
It's so interesting you should say that, because, I mean, this is something that Philip O'Kelly wrote about recently about lockdown in Bucharest. And I guess it's that sense of countries with a recent history of fascism or any kind of totalitarian government can quickly assemble riot mob and, you know, scary riot police and armed guards in what are ultimately sort of Belle Epoque boulevards. And there is that phenomenon, because I know someone described this to me in Rome, of turning a corner and just seeing the riot police filling the entire boulevard and asking their friend immediately, are they real? Like, thinking they were robots, the inhumanity of this vista is not something we see in Ireland, but it's kind of a European thing. And this story is set, I suppose it's set in Spain. I mean, it takes a lot of images from a lot of places, but that one is a European image, I think, that suddenly meeting the riot police. And as you say, death, the first thing that comes into your mind.
This is it.
So deep and dark and symbolic and frightening.
Yeah, yeah. And that, and having that lie on the periphery of the story is an achievement in itself, not to kind of, and like you were talking about, written with kind of with a really mature hand or something. And that's something like that. I'm thinking of myself writing around that time. I would have been honing it. I would have been bringing all that stuff front and center. It would have been sitting on the page on top of all the lovely sentences, and it just would have been so blatant. But he just, having it lurk around the corner, having Jerry kind of as a kind of, you know, some kind of weird bootlegger type, but also beating up the wrong side of the tracks type guy, having him kind of lurk just in different days. He pops in and out, and just very, very calm, confident way of delivering something like that, delivering those kind of aspects.
And then it's sort of becoming at places like it's a dream, or it's passing into the surreal, and it's not really happening. Like, Jerry is apparently killed here, but then he comes back.
And lots of phrases like I must have been, or Isabel must have been there, this kind of confusion,
which is part of the drinking,
which is real.
It's combining
at the end of the story, that's a reality thing. What did happen,
combining the blackout drinking with the nightmare closing in of this. Yeah, I think of it as being very, because it borrows so promiscuously from all these different images and imaginaries and influences, it's that it seems unrealistic, but then it's always teetering on the edge of being believable.
Yeah. Fantastic. Did you have any theories, or I'm kind of dropping you in it here, but did you have any theories or thoughts about this fat boy standing by the tree?
I kept on wondering if that was a reference to something I was missing.
I think, like, to be honest,
classical reference or some icon.
We'll have to get Kevin, and we'll have to pick Kevin's brains at some point. But I think, like, one of my, like I mentioned Lynch earlier, one of my favorite things about Lynch is the symbols don't have to be explained. The fact that he's just there the whole time, kind of, and at the end, kind of seemingly kind of asks to be set on fire. I don't know. It's enough. It's enough of to enjoy just the symbol alone, isn't it? This poor old boy, and the poor old tree as well, the old withering tree,
and the cockroaches. Because another sort of thing about going to packet holidays is that you meet cockroaches for the first time.
Yeah,
and they're a really memorable part of that experience, because we don't really have them here. They're associated with going on holidays in grotty places and leaving food out and standing on them in the dark. And they're also this potent symbol of nuclear fallout, because they can apparently survive They'll be the only things left.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's doing with the cockroaches, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, definitely making me think of those holidays and making me think of nuclear fallout, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a book called Sex Lives of the Nazi Doctors? I've been afraid to Google it in case there isn't.
No, I think that's maybe a riff off those documentaries that people like to watch called Nazi Superstructures. And
Exactly. It's an airport paperback called
Which is this lurid, or, you know, Jack the Ripper books with all the photographs in them and that appetite for gruesomeness.
Incredible. And like, again, just all points to that kind of maturity and, you know, right at the start of his career, before he's published a book, this kind of just a feeling of authority or something. They always say that about like footballers, like the best footballers, even when they're young, they just have a sense of authority. They carry themselves and they do their work, their footballing, with a sense of authority. I definitely think that's true of writers. I think we had a podcast on Claire Louise Bennett a while back, and I remember feeling the same thing reading it again, like you would never think this was a person's first book, or from a person's first book, you know,
or even this being quite a young person writing and having this level of control. And I think, I'm guessing, it's the result of a very close study of good writers.
Yeah absolutely. Well, like all good writing, I suppose, is a result of really good reading. Or in my experiences. And just so, going back to the generational thing, actually, do you feel then, or is this work that you're talking about revolving around an idea that writing is a generational thing? Like that there is, obviously, if a load of writers who grew up in the 90s are all writing books, there are going to be things you can draw from them. But do you feel like that there's a kind of a relationship, like I should have a relationship as a writer to my generation that I should be thinking about it? Or do you think that it's just happening, like no matter what I would write, it would be a result of me being from a particular generation? Is there a link there that you're exploring?
I think there's a couple of things feeding into this for me, because I didn't think of myself as a generation, belonging to a generation, and I still don't. But my book is read as a millennial woman's book. And I really didn't think that would happen. I was kind of naive. So I have been slotted into this. And then, because it doesn't really make sense as a millennial woman's book, because it doesn't look at the internet and it doesn't talk about these things that millennials are meant to be interested in, like social justice and so on, it just gets left out of the discussion. And I feel a little bit frustrated at that, because it's not being read in its own merits. So I thought I'd have to take this generational crap seriously and have a look at it. And then I got this sense, because I felt like I belonged more spiritually to Generation X, and I identify more with the 90s idea of Ireland as a place that's kind of emerging from tradition and fighting back against things and reckoning with the past, not this kind of plainer online non-place where millennials live that doesn't interest me. So I feel more like a Generation X writer. And then I was watching Barry McRae did some conversations with Generation X people, talking to Belinda McKeown. And she just happened to say, well, when I was writing in the 90s, I believed that no publishing house wanted to buy an Irish writer that didn't sound like Seamus Heaney or Don McGarren. And she seemed to just come say this kind of quite candidly. And it struck me as, that's what Julian Gough was giving out about all that time. You know, he kept on trying to tell everybody that, that they were being ignored because they weren't doing Heaney. They weren't honoring an image of the troubles in Northern Ireland and stuff. And that it was kind of like, to be Irish was a bit of an albatross. So I started looking at this kind of lost generation of writers who are trying to write the 90s or write out of the 90s in Ireland, and seeing this strangely volatile, very boozy, druggy, sort of going out and wandering around Europe atmosphere. Yeah, yeah. And it nearly felt like, because of all of this this struggle and kind of scattering, this whole sudden millennial generation thing was able to happen. I'm just kind of interested in these things. And I mean, I think writers really don't like me doing this, because they get very annoyed when I start putting them into silos, and it's not my intention. I'm just more, you have to reckon with the crossover between, you know, the marketing of writers as Irish and the experience of just happening to be a writer who is Irish. So I've been writing an essay about it, and I just was trying to sort of remember and explain what I meant by writers belonging to this generation, and this story falls very squarely into the aesthetic that I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And I think if writers are going to be packaged in marketing terms, which is happens every day of the year, then we might as well examine, or it's important to examine what the reality behind that is, whether
Yes, absolutely.
I remember actually starting out a great Gen X novelist who hasn't written a novel in a long time, I don't think, Eamon Sweeney. He writes journalism for the Sunday Independent as well.
I have not heard of him.
He's a Sligo writer. Waiting for the Healer was a brilliant book. Mm-hmm. And not his own. There's another novel that I can't quite recall now. But I remember him saying, meeting him at a boozy Quirch event, probably around 2005, 2006. Mm. And him saying to me, like, just when you're writing your novel now, just don't let it be this thing where you just take people on a tourist's tour of Ireland. Mm. Just don't do it. Mm. And I kind of got it a bit, I think, what he was talking about then. But I don't think I got it to the extent that I get it now. And I did actually go on and write a first novel that was me trying to, not exactly trying to write the Celtic Tiger novel, but trying to write Ireland for a UK audience so that I would get a UK book deal. And it was it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great. And I'm delighted it never did see the light of day.
That's interesting.
Because
you were writing quite realist and then you flipped to speculative then.
Yeah, just writing the country as I, like, kind of almost saying, like, come in and have a look around here and I'll explain mm-hmm. all these things to you, I'll explain what hurling is and I'll explain why I think Irish people are this way. And mm-hmm. it was literally me taking a tourist by the hand, which was a terrible, terrible way to approach anything. And even though I'd gotten that great advice from him and Sweeney, I went, oh, yeah, don't worry, I'm not going to try and be, again, like Seamus Heaney or something like that. And a lot of my influences would have been American, at the same time, there I was making that mistake.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, when you're writing that kind of work, in a way, I think you're trying to maybe yourself process what it means to be Irish and a sense of identity, because that's important. I mean, I would have read a lot of American writing when I was younger as well. When I was a teenager, I was really into Bret Easton Ellis and I was really into Douglas Copeland.
Okay,
I kind of thought I would be that kind of a writer. So this is sort of what I thought I would do. And then I got John McGarren, can't really explain it, just fell in love and spent 4 years doing a PhD, which is essentially about trying to explain Irishness as a feeling or grappling with the identity in an ambivalent way. And then looking at the country from the outside. And now I find it absolutely fascinating because it is like writing Ireland is like writing a small microcosm of politics and class in a small place where I can get a handle on it. And I just can't stop writing about it. I think it's so interesting from a human perspective. And I've seen sort of feedback from my book. I think it was somewhere online where someone was saying, oh yeah, I really appreciate the way this writer doesn't code switch for an American audience. And it just struck me that like I would never have even occurred to me to do that. Because then I would lose all the specificity, which is why I think it's interesting. Like, I don't think that there's one grand narrative across the English-speaking world that is stable. I think that if the more you look at a location, the more you draw out complexities. But I feel free to do that because I'm not writing in the shadow of Seamus Heaney.
Absolutely. But you know something that you've just touched on there that I think is really interesting and that I particularly loved about this happy is that sense that, and obviously I'm reading as an Irish person, so I don't have that outer perspective of how it's presented to a non-Irish audience, whatever, but just the feeling of, like you mentioned the word location, and mentioned the word place, the feeling of it being a novel that was lived in, that was full of physical detritus, like phone chargers hanging about the place, hanging out of things. There was always weather happening. It felt like a Kurosawa movie or something where it's really raining and it's really windy and things like that. And that is something that I think, well, maybe that's, you worked at McGarren for a long time and obviously that's one of his big things is like they're very physical books, but maybe it's something that marks you apart also from that kind of millennial novel is an attention to physical things like weather and Detroit, like, as you mentioned, millennials kind of increasingly live, and we all increasingly live in virtual spaces, but millennials are maybe particularly not, they're not as attentive to that kind of stuff. It's not as important anymore.
Yes. Thank you so much for the kind words, first of all. I do think that is important to me. It's how, first of all, it's just how I remember things, as I always remember them with weather. And it's just kind of a neurological thing. But I am very opposed to the online omnispace aesthetic, because I think that it's masquerading as boundlessly inclusive, but really it's very inhuman. The idea that we will be located nowhere and that our effective relationships will be online, it just feels like walking off the plank willingly. A way, in this story, that this story is about sort of cultivating callousness and being, you know, in this non-place of complete obliterative drunkenness when the world is happening around you. And I just dislike the online idea about you've got to represent it, because it just feels like that's not where anybody really lives. They actually live in a place. But then again, if you drive, you're writing an Irish place, you've got this inheritance that, oh, you're just doing exactly that. You're doing tourism, or you're writing the countryside in order to be consumed by people outside of it. And therefore it's kind of more complicated. And yeah, I find that a really fascinating drive in writing. Yeah.
But also maybe it could also be an attention thing, in terms of we still have access to, and maybe it depends where you come from as well and things like this, but we still have access to memories of feeling cold and feeling warm and being out and hanging. Like there was a great line in a podcast I was listening to the other day about parenthood, and the guy was saying, well, I just let them out and they come home when they're hungry. he was saying that was the way it was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
We were just let out and we went home and we were hungry. So they were out in the world, experiencing the world. And I think that is decreasing. And so I think, and it's not that it's the world is not there anymore. The world is still there, but you're not attentive to it, or younger people aren't attentive to it.
Absolutely. And if you are that attention economy where you're always online, it's another way of, I think this is with my students sometimes, it allows people not to notice that the environment around them is being incrementally destroyed and turned more and more brutal and horrific. So sometimes I do look around and say, well, why would anybody want to be in the moment here? This place is disgusting. And it's like the compensation then is, oh, you're in this magical glittering pixel realm of endless possibility, which is ultimately just an advertising platform.
Yeah.
I think artists should push against this stuff, not embrace it, but
because I similarly, but maybe slightly differently, I constantly find myself when working with new writers or student writers saying, put me in the room. Like I can't see anything. And I think it's, and they kind of go, oh yeah, I just don't really like, sometimes you get the response, I just don't really like descriptive writing that much. And you're thinking, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You can be sparse, but we have to know like roughly where we are and what's around the place.
Yeah, that's
the reader has to feel part of the experience. And it kind of, I don't know, like maybe all new writers like that, but it kind of made me start to think about like whether they just aren't as attentive to all that stuff, because focus and attention are always pointed in the direction of a screen or something, or increasingly pointed in the direction of a screen.
That's quite sad. I mean, it's good to be aware of it and agitate against it, though, I think, because it's not... It doesn't make for political subjects, I think, that can really fight back if there's a sense of self as being atomized and disembodied. It just doesn't feel, it feels wrong politically to me. But I mean, descriptive writing has probably gone too far and needs to kind of, you know, there was this sort of creative writing master's style of laboredly describing everything to the point of death, that it's only got itself to blame for that. It's got a bad name now. It needs to repent for a while. Things meet in the middle somewhere.
Hopefully, to come back around. Because I still love reading it. I think we could talk all day, Niamh, but
we should probably start wrapping up, though, in terms of the short attention spans of ourselves and the listenership.
Podcasts that happen in the no space.
Yes. Well, Zencaster.
Yeah. Listen, thanks a million for a wonderful reading and a wonderful discussion. Thanks to our producer, Ian Mullaney. A big thanks to the Arts Council, who support everything we do. And the biggest thanks of all to you, the listeners. If you like the podcast, do please subscribe. And until next time, go easy, both in the no space and in the real physical, lovely weather-filled world.